Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on State Senator Eddie Melton taking steps towards a gubernatorial run in 2020. The Gary Community School Corp issued an apology after a teacher awarded an autistic student a trophy, naming him the most annoying male. Senator Elizabeth Warren held a rally in the Hoosier State, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Jenny McCabe, the assistant director at the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. State Senator Eddie Melton is the first Indiana Democrat to take formal steps towards a gubernatorial run in 2020. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Melton announced the formation of an exploratory committee in Gary.
Melton, a first-term senator from Gary, is also deputy chair of the Indiana Democratic Party. He says as he's traveled his district and the state, he's listened to the issues that Hoosier voters are concerned about. Chief among them, Melton says, education.
When we're ranked so low when it comes down to teacher pay, and especially per-student spending.
Melton is the highest-ranking Democrat on the Senate Education Committee and a former member of the State Board of Education. He would also be the first person of color ever nominated to run for governor by a major party in Indiana. That's something he says he views as an opportunity, not a challenge.
I see it as an opportunity to show the vast diversity that this state has.
Melton says he hasn't set a timetable to officially decide on a gubernatorial run. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Gary Community School Corp has issued an apology after a special needs teacher awarded an 11-year-old autistic student a trophy, naming him the most annoying male of the school year. Emergency manager Peter Morekis called it an unfortunate occurrence and declined to comment on the employment status of the teacher involved. The Times reports the Bailey Preparatory Academy teacher gave the boy the trophy May 23rd during a fifth grade awards luncheon attended by students, parents, and the school principal. Rick Castillon, the boy's father, said the family was blindsided. Castillon said his son is nonverbal, occasionally rocks back and forth, and can become easily emotional. He said he has received calls from the school when his son didn't want to work or would cry. Castillon's family met with Marikas after the lunch to discuss their concerns, and he was confident the district would take action. He goes on to say Marikas talked about putting the teacher on a 2-week suspension and possible dismissal. Castillon said he was pleased with Marikas' response, but that he chose to speak out so other students with special needs never experience the same kind of treatment.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Police are investigating alleged animal abuse after an animal rights group released graphic video showing workers kicking and throwing young calves at Fair Oaks Farm, a popular destination for school field trips. Animal Recovery Mission says an investigator for the Miami-based group secretly recorded the disturbing footage last year while working at Fair Oaks Farm, which Food and Wine magazine has called the Disneyland of agricultural tourism. The group says the footage shows the, quote, daily mistreatment of the resident farm animals at the farm's dairies. Fair Oaks Farm's founder, Mike McCloskey, says four employees seen in the video have been fired and action has been taken to prevent further abuse. The Newton County Sheriff's Office is investigating the alleged abuse.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities say two men are facing charges after they allegedly ransacked a Northwest Indiana church and left behind painted hate messages. The Times reports Hammond police announced Saturday that 23-year-old Aaron J. Van Opens and 22-year-old Nicholas D. Redding were charged with one count each of burglary and institutional criminal mischief. Court records Monday didn't list lawyers for the Hammond men. Police say the interior of Faith United Church of Christ Rise in Hammond sustained significant damage. Officers responded last Wednesday morning after it was discovered. An altar, an organ, restrooms, a display case, and an office were damaged during the break-in and subsequent vandalism. Church council member Janice Barney said that hate messages that included "Hail Satan" were also painted inside the church, and its interior was trashed.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Elizabeth Warren made her first Indiana campaign stop in Elkhart on Thursday morning. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart reports.
Elizabeth Warren says she has a plan for everything. That's what she's used to make herself stand out from the crowded field of Democratic hopefuls. In Elkhart, she outlined three of those.
Just three things that I want to do. Attack the corruption so we can make real change in this country. Get a couple of structural changes in this economy and protect our democracy.
She spoke of getting rid of lobbying, fighting voter suppression and gerrymandering, and the tax she wants to put on wealth over $50 million, and what could be done with that money instead, like paying for college and abolishing student loan debt. Caitlin Steinheiser is a junior at Valparaiso University and a member of its College Democrats. That college plan is part of what drew her to the rally.
She has a debt calculator on her website, and it shows how many of your student loans will be canceled. And I know a lot of people have actually been doing that, and that's very encouraging.
Warren is only the second Democratic candidate to campaign in Indiana. She also stopped in Fort Wayne. The state's primaries aren't until May, making it a traditionally low priority for those seeking the nomination. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Division of Historic Preservation and Archaeology is conducting an online survey to gather public input regarding upcoming projects and initiatives. It says its Cultural Resources Management Plan is a comprehensive state plan that guides local preservationists, state officials, and others in their efforts to preserve Indiana's heritage resources, including historic downtowns and neighborhoods, bridges, cemeteries, schools, round barns, and other rural sites, theaters, and archaeological sites. The agency is currently revising its plan for 2020 through 2026. People can access the survey online at www.in.gov/DNR/historic/10147. Those without internet access can connect to the survey at any public library, or they can request a paper copy by mail by calling Steve Kennedy at 317-232-6981. Completed survey forms must be returned to the agency by June 30th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A proposed South Bend clinic that performs abortions has the go-ahead to finally open after a federal judge ordered the state to clear a path. Whole Woman's Health Alliance has been trying to open a clinic in the northern Indiana city since 2017, but the state refused to issue a license, saying what it said was incomplete and inaccurate information in the alliance's application. After a lengthy administrative appeal failed, the alliance tried to apply a second time last year. And after the state again threw up roadblocks, the healthcare organization sued. Federal Judge Sarah Evans Barker sided with Whole Woman's Health. She says the state's licensing law is a significant and largely unnecessary burden to women's legal access to abortion. From her decision, Barker writes, the state stands to lose little if an injunction is issued, but women in northern Indiana stand to lose a great deal if it is not. The legal battle will likely continue as the state can appeal the judge's decision.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The ACLU was in court Monday to ask a judge to prevent Indiana's latest anti-abortion law from going into effect. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports the law would largely ban the most common form of second trimester abortions from being performed in Indiana.
The 2019 law largely bans the second trimester procedures known as dilation and evacuation abortions, or DNEs. Doctors who perform DNEs would be subject to a level 5 5 felony and could be sued in civil court by the woman who undergoes the procedure, the father of the fetus, and the woman's parents. The ACLU is representing Dr. Caitlin Bernard, who is one of 2 doctors in the state performing the procedure. She says she felt an obligation to sue the state on behalf of her patients.
Anything that is intruding into my practice and being able to take care of my patients, I need to speak up and fight.
The law goes into effect on July 1st. Federal Judge Sarah Evans Barker said at the conclusion of the hearing she would make a decision before that date. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana has one of the highest rates of eviction in the country. Only 6 states are worse. In Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, many community activists point to one issue as a major cause.
3 of Indiana's biggest cities are in the top 20 in the country among comparably sized communities for highest eviction rates: Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, and South Bend. Prosperity Indiana's Jessica Love, like many community advocates, points to a major issue the state must address to help reduce evictions.
They must also include more resources to fund the expansion of affordable housing.
Judy Fox runs the Economic Justice Clinic in South Bend. She says she'd also like to see Indiana create an eviction expungement process.
If you've been were evicted 10 years ago, why is that still on your record and preventing people from renting to you?
Some community leaders say there's hope for federal action, spearheaded in part by Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Teacher pay and school funding were central issues for policymakers as they crafted the state's spending plan earlier this year. But the unpredictable structure of funding support in the state can be challenging for schools. About a third of Indiana's school districts have asked their local communities for more funding through voter-approved tax hikes known as referendum measures. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay explains that support is vital for schools facing big cuts.
The steel mills of northern Indiana inspired the River Forest Community School's mascot, the Ingots.
I wish I would have brought my Ingot shirt today.
And as high school senior Julian Wilson talks with a couple of his classmates, a clear theme emerges: school pride.
And being in this school has really made me feel that Ingot spirit, and I really wanted to just share that with people and really give them my point of view.
He's talking about the funding referendum voters recently passed for the district. He's one of a handful of students who spoke with local taxpayers to get more of them to say yes, and they did. Superintendent Steve Disney says without those dollars, a lot was at stake.
Teaching positions, the staff positions, to looking at transportation for extracurriculars.
River Forest and the rest of Lake County schools are gearing up for a financial challenge most public schools in Indiana have faced for nearly a decade: property tax caps. When the caps went into place, lawmakers gave Lake and St. Joseph counties a decade to adapt. So starting next year, Disney says River Forest will be cut off from collecting about another $600,000 in local funding.
What that means at River Forest, that increase of $600,000 loss would have amounted to our entire transportation program.
And there aren't enough state dollars coming in. 2 main factors determine most state support: student enrollment and number of students in poverty. So some schools could see little or no increases, while others lose money. Combined with limits on property taxes, that leaves many public schools scrambling for cash.
We have become, I'm very honest to say, we have become a referendum state.
Denny Costerson, executive director of the Indiana Association of School Business Officials, says past funding changes mean some schools already have more money than others.
There are discrepancies in this state. There's some equity issues, meaning that some districts, because of whatever circumstances in the past, are in a better situation fiscally than others are.
Some districts rely on voters to pass referenda often, but not all communities can or want to. Franklin Community Schools, just outside of Indianapolis, proposed a referendum for the first time this year. The district built a new high school around the time tax caps started. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Mercer says voters would have probably rejected a referendum then.
There was a lot of consternation about the building of the high school. So for us, 10 years ago, doing a referendum was not an option.
Mercer says the district has lost out on more than $27 million in local funding with the caps in place, and state support isn't enough. He says the recently passed referendum will help close growing gaps for things like teacher pay between districts.
We had a teacher take a $21,000 pay increase to do the same job in a different district. That's a problem.
Because keeping teachers in class means stability for kids.
You know, we can all survive on less or more money, and if you don't like what you make, you can go somewhere else and survive it. Those kids have no choice. That's where they're at.
Lawmakers will study school funding this summer to figure out how best to target dollars to the most in-need schools, and they plan to study the effects of school referenda on teacher pay. In the meantime, schools have to rely on their communities to keep classrooms open or have fewer of them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
In some U.S. cities, officials are taking a fresh look at gun violence and treating it as a public health issue. That means examining how it can lead to anxiety, stress, and other mental health problems. Christine Herman of Slight Effects Public Media reports on a new effort in Illinois that aims to help people recover from traumatic experience.
Yvonne Johnson lost her son, David Sankey, last August. He was 16.
That was my baby. That's all I had. And somebody decided to come on his block and fire a gun. Not one time, six shots. One kid hit mine.
Sankey was one of the eight people who died from gun violence last year in Champaign-Urbana, home of the University of Illinois. More than 100 others were shot and survived. Sankey's grandmother, Legatrice Benton Miniweather, says losing him is the most painful thing she's ever experienced.
I've been around David ever since he was born. It wasn't hardly a day I didn't see him. I loved him so much. He loved me so much. And at the time this happened, I didn't know what to do. I was just lost.
So lost, she considered taking her own life.
I feel like somebody just snatched my heart out of my body. I don't feel I will ever recover from this.
Sankey's relative spoke recently to a group at Jericho Missionary Baptist Church. They said the support of community and church members was vital to them making it through. The meeting was the area's first violence response forum. Police, schools, and government officials came together to provide support and other resources following a violent incident. In this case, a shooting that took place just blocks from the church. One person was injured, and another, Elijah Booker, was killed. He was 14.
We are here to let you know that you are not alone.
Patricia Avery is part of the local violence response team.
We know that there are people out there that are trying to cope and understand what is going on. There is too much violence. There is too much pain. There is too much suffering. And so we as a community have to stand together.
All across the U.S., cities are stepping up to address the impact of violence. In the Midwest, Cleveland and Chicago have launched programs like the one in Champaign. And the Indianapolis City Council has formally declared gun violence a public health issue. University of Maryland epidemiologist Wendy Lane says these initiatives can really help. She studies the effects of trauma on women who live in one of Baltimore's most violent areas.
Their stress levels are incredibly high, and they feel that anxiety from being constantly exposed to traumatic events.
That exposure can lead to long-term anxiety and depression. Lane says efforts to wrap support around people after violent incidents can help prevent some of those problems, with one caveat.
Just coming in right after it happens isn't going to be the only solution. There has to be ongoing services.
And she says those services need to reach the people who need them most. But to really address community violence, Lane says cities must address root causes, like poverty. At the Violence Response Forum in Champaign, Police Chief Anthony Cobb echoed that sentiment.
And the root cause is how we're going to help our young people. How do we invest in them? How we help them to feel good so they're not as apathetic and they don't want to go down these paths? How we make those paths look less inviting to them? That's where the community is going to come together at. And so that's how we're going to resolve that issue.
Organizers say they'll continue to refine the violence response program based on the advice of residents. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
In the past year, the number of teens using e-cigarettes has increased by 78%, and experts are worried. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Eldana spoke with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Matt Pelser about the rising numbers and what she is hearing from communities across Indiana.
Matt, yeah, I started reporting on this topic after reading the 2018 National Youth Tobacco Survey. It said basically that there was a big surge in e-cigarette use among youth. That's 1.5 million more students were using e-cigs in 2018 compared to 2017. In Indiana, vaping increased for all 7th through 12th graders last year, especially in teen boys. So after seeing these numbers, our community outreach team wanted to go out in cities like Kokomo and Terre Haute to hear how residents are handling the problem.
Well, so then what are some of the things that you heard?
Well, mostly that there's lack of information. Teachers and parents don't always know what vaping or vape pens look like. And of course, the company Juul always comes up.
And Juul is the California company that is dominating the e-cigarette market right now.
That's right. And they're really popular among teens. So sometimes these vape pens or Juuls, they're easy to hide. They're really small and they produce like little smoke. Also, users themselves, the teens that I spoke to, they don't know how much nicotine is in these products. And the National Academy of Medicine, they say teens who use e-cigarettes are three times more likely to transition to traditional cigarettes.
Well, and that's what's concerning, right? As we know, nicotine is an addictive substance. So how prevalent is the use among teens?
They're everywhere. So we spoke to two high school students in Terre Haute, Sasha and Kayla, and they say a lot of their classmates Juul.
Everyone at school has one, and they'll do it like if you just bend down and blow the smoke under the table.
You're in school?
Yeah, 100%. In almost every class I'm in, someone's doing almost.
If the teachers know it's happening, like the teachers aren't stupid. It's not like they're just turning a blind eye about this.
And I asked them about the consequences at school if you're caught with a Juul or a vape pen, and they say students do get in trouble. They get it taken away. And a parent is notified, but they don't know of any resources set up to help if a student is dependent on these nicotine-filled devices. So right now, yes, schools have rules in place that prohibit any tobacco products, but as a health reporter, I started asking if there are any resources for students, especially if they do develop a dependency. And at the listening session in Terre Haute, a school representative that focuses on improving mental health resources at her school district, she said trying to punish everyone is overwhelming, and they want to work on prevention instead.
Because we're seeing so many of these infractions come through the administration building, through expulsion hearings and things, we need to create some kind of prevention or education program that with those offenses comes participation.
So what about the health risks then? We know that traditional cigarettes are harmful. What do we know about electronic cigarettes?
Well, we don't know much about the long-term effects of e-cigarettes and vape use, and there's debate on whether or not they're safer than traditional cigarettes. But when we're talking about teens, and some as young as 12 and 13, of course this is a concern. A Juul pod contains as much nicotine as a pack of traditional cigarettes. So experts can agree on one thing, and that's that nicotine and the developing brain, that's not a good mix. A pediatrician at the Kokomo listening session we were at, Dr. Dana Stewart, she says there can be long-term effects.
Nicotine itself affects the prefrontal cortex, and so that is responsible for our executive decision-making skills and also our ability to pay attention, to focus. And so there's definitely been studies that have shown that that is affected by nicotine.
So then did you hear from parents? What's their take on this?
Parents did attend the sessions, and I think they just feel like there's a lack of resources and information. For instance, what do you do if your middle schooler or high schooler is trying these vape pens, e-cigarettes, and then they become dependent? That's a concern. So anyone who wants to learn more about e-cigarettes can find our stories at sideeffectspublicmedia.org, and the FDA website has a lot of information, including its anti-smoking campaign called The Real Cost.
Thank you, Araceli.
Thanks, Matt.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Janet McCabe, Assistant Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute.
The cities of Gary and Michigan City are participating along with 11 other communities here in Indiana as part of the Indiana University's first resilience cohort. It's a way to take a look at the issue of greenhouse gas emissions in communities and local governments as well and how to deal with them. And we have with us to talk more about the project over the state and a little more details about what's happening in our communities, Janet McCabe. She's the Assistant Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. Pardon me, it's based in the Bloomington campus, and she works out of IUPUI. Why as well. Janet, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about the importance of being able to do a greenhouse gas inventory and really how Hoosier cities and towns and counties really need to keep track of that.
Well, this is a really exciting opportunity for Hoosier local governments. We know from a lot of research that's being done here and elsewhere that our climate is changing and that we need to get a handle on the greenhouse gases that are being emitted that are helping to cook the planet. And so this program allows these cities to inventory, basically to get an understanding of what greenhouse gases are being emitted in their cities, in their communities, and also, if they wish, within state government itself. And if you know the old saying, you can't manage what you don't measure, until we have a sense of where the greenhouse gases are coming from, it's really hard to design programs that will help us reduce and mitigate those emissions.
I know we take a look at the greenhouse gas emissions on the literally the global basis, or whether we talk about beyond just the community basis here, but there is something that we should know about, I guess. As you mentioned, the inventory is going to help keep track of, because there are problems that happen here at home, not only with climate change and other things, too, that do come down to not knowing where the greenhouse gases are coming out and the impact that they're having, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, there are just so many things to know about keeping track of this. So one thing we do know is that every ton of additional carbon that goes into the atmosphere is going to increase the effects that global warming and climate change is going to have on our communities. And that means hotter temperatures. It means more rain when we don't need it and less rain when we do need it. And just as an interesting little statistic, in Lake County, if now people are used to having just a couple of days a year, really, really hot days, like over 95 degrees, by the middle of the century, Lake County can expect to have a month's worth of days over 95 degrees. So just think about the impacts that will have on people in their daily lives. Do they have air conditioning or do they not have air conditioning? How much time do they spend outside? What does it mean for landscaping? What does it mean for infrastructure? All these sorts of things that, what does it mean for mosquitoes and allergens and that sort of thing? So this, we're talking about real impacts on people's communities. So we want to do the best we can to reduce those emissions. But there are other advantages too, because if a mayor finds out through doing this inventory that he or she is spending a lot on old, perhaps energy inefficient heating and cooling systems, which are one of our biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, that mayor would then have some support to look at designing a program to upgrade, invest in more energy efficiency, which not only reduces greenhouse gases, it reduces other air pollution. And it also saves the taxpayer money. It's just, win-win all around.
Well, taking a look at our communities here in Gary and Michigan City in particular, how do they get involved in getting on the list, so to speak, so that they're one of the communities that are getting involved in this first resilience cohort?
Yeah, good question. And I want to give a shout out to both of those communities for stepping up for this first opportunity. So the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute, which you mentioned, which is one of the university's grand challenge initiatives, is supported working with our IU Sustainability Office, supported by the McKinney Family Foundation, to provide a summer intern to each of a bunch of cities who want to do this. This is the first time that we're doing this. It's basically no cost to the cities. They get a trained intern from IU, either a undergrad or a graduate student, to spend 10 weeks working on this. And we at the Institute worked out a relationship with an organization that provides software and training for cities that want to do these inventories. So there's a very well-developed protocol that people can learn how to do to collect the information that you need and put it in the right format. So we've got 13 cities all across the state, all the way from Evansville in the south to Gary and Michigan City and Goshen in the north, big cities, small cities. We have Oldenburg, Indiana, which has 600 people and is the smallest city ever to do one of these inventories. So we knew that Michigan City and Gary were both cities that are being very proactive when it comes to sustainability and resilience work. And when we put out the solicitation, anybody want to do this, they stepped right up right away.
And we know that Brenda Scott Henry is involved with the city of Gary's Green Urbanism Department, and I'm not surprised that she would be the first on the list to be sure that the city of Gary got a chance to get some help in looking into the issues of greenhouse gas emissions. When it comes down to actually measuring around the community to see where these gases seem to be collecting, at least where the spots that seem to be the most prevalent for these, is it something similar than what the Indiana Department of Environmental Management certainly has done for years up here in the region and in dealing with the pollution problems?
Well, it's not unrelated. So the Department of Environmental Management has programs that collect pollution information from industry, from large industrial operations in Lake County, actually all across the state. And those sources, like the steel mills and the power plants and the refineries and all, have to report their emissions of air pollution. There's no requirement in the same way for reporting emissions of greenhouse gases. There is a little bit, actually, but not at the level that would give you a sense of what's happening in the community. So a lot of our greenhouse gas emissions come from our use of power and heating and cooling and electricity needs. A lot of it comes from transportation. So it's about a third comes from power use, about a third comes from transportation. And the way you get a sense of emissions coming from transportation is kind of what NDOT does, working with the Department of Environmental Management to look at the vehicle fleet and the miles traveled and make some estimates about where those emissions are coming from.
Now, what's the communities, Gary and Michigan City and Goshen, as you mentioned, and the others that are involved in the resilience cohort this summer or get their information turned in, what happens to it from that point on? You folks at the Institute take it from there, and in turn we'll get back to the communities that are involved in this and get them more information to get them directed in the right direction, getting the right equipment, getting the right vehicles on the road to keep the pollution down?
Well, that's a great question, because you collect this information, then you don't want it to just sit there. So Michigan City and Gary, as we've already said, are very proactive cities. So I know that they will be eager to have this information so that they can then start putting together a plan, a resilience plan. The city of South Bend is a little bit ahead of these cities because they've already done this inventory, so they're now in the process of developing a plan that will include specific actions that will be prioritized based on the information that they collected. The Institute where I work and the Grand Challenge is already providing resources to cities and towns. Even if you aren't doing this inventory project or you haven't gotten the results yet, it's not too soon to be looking at, well, maybe we should be investing in electric vehicles in our community or electric vehicle charging infrastructure so that our residents who have electric cars will have places to charge them. Maybe we should be looking into solar energy or buying wind energy maybe we should be looking at some kind of an energy audit. And so through the Institute and through our website, we have lots and lots of information for cities and towns already and are eager to help anybody that would want to reach out. In particular, we have a tool called the Environmental Resilience Institute Toolkit, or ERIT, where we have lots of information, resources specifically for cities and towns, although anybody can use it, and people can go on there, and if they're interested in what is going on with climate change and indoor air quality, or climate change and wetlands or water quality, they can look that up, and we have examples, case studies from what other cities, especially around the Midwest, have done to try to become more resilient around those issues. And, you know, we understand at IU that mayors and county commissioners and such in Indiana are need this information, but it's not super helpful to have the examples be cities like Miami or New York City, which are huge, and also on the coast, and so they're dealing with coastal issues. We're dealing with Midwestern issues. We're dealing with flooding and hot temperatures and what's going to happen to our agricultural economy and what's happening to our tree species and that sort of thing. And also, we have a lot of small to mid-sized cities who can't do the kinds of things that Chicago can do, or even Indianapolis. So they need examples from smaller cities, from comparable cities around the Midwest. And that's what we try to do at the Environmental Resilience Institute.
And we know the cohort has just gotten underway with their real work. They had the folks from campus help out starting this month, and it's going to continue on, I guess, it went until September. And by that time, you hope to have enough information together to be able to turn back over to the communities to give them the guidance for what they need to do?
Yep. Well, that's our hope. In fact, Gary, I think, is having their kickoff meeting this afternoon. So they'll be working all over the summer while the students are available, and we're confident that that's enough time to pull this information together. And then we'll want to work with each of these cities to see what it is they want to do next. This is very much driven by what the cities themselves want to do and what their leadership wants to do and what the communities want to do. There's so many positive things that can happen in communities as a result of these kinds of activities. And I think a lot of times people get sort of overwhelmed by the notion of climate change because it seems like such a huge problem, and if I recycle my one Coke can, is that really going to make much difference? What can I do that can make a difference? And it's easy to feel that way, but it's really important that we understand that there are so many positive things that we can do, and there are good things to look forward to, not just doom and gloom.
I know it's very easy to get scared about these things, especially when we note, like you mentioned, the fact that we're going to have hotter than usual summers. That's just going to be the case. We're going to have much more rain. We've already complained about having too much rain already and dealing with the problems in the communities with flooding and the like. And they see it on the Kankakee River and the Yellow River now because we've had all this rainfall, more than what we usually expect in the spring. And we're just probably going to panic about that in the months ahead, too, won't we, if we don't have the right data to be able to go into it right.
That's right. And, of course, data is power, right? When you have data, then you can understand things better, and then they're not as scary. And this is about our kids. This is making sure that when our kids and grandkids grow up, they have an Indiana that's as wonderful to live in as we've had, and or even more wonderful, and not be afraid that the kinds of things that we can do to ensure that kind of a future will be good for us today. Will make our homes more comfortable, will make it cheaper for us to heat and cool our homes and get around town, will make healthier communities, more sidewalks, more green space. That's all good for air pollution, which of course is a concern in Gary and Northwest Indiana more than a lot of other parts of the state. Let's clean up the air and clean up the water and provide better quality of living for everybody now, and that will help us in the future.
Now, as we go through the summer months and the data is collected and gathered and sent on to the Institute later, what's likely to be the place where people can find out how things have turned out in their communities or around the state of Indiana, and how Environmental Resilience Institute rather is going to be able to put all this together into a report? Where can you find out later a little bit more?
Well, actually, the cities who are doing these inventories, they own this data. This is their project and their information. So I expect that the cities will be deciding how they're going to make the information available to people in the way that makes most sense to them. And the Environmental Resilience Institute will work with them to help them do that and then work with them to think about what next steps might be.
Jan McCabe is the Assistant Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. The institute is working with the cities of Gary, Andy, Chicago, and Michigan City, and a number of others here around Indiana during the summer months collecting this data about greenhouse gas emissions to be able to put together what is being now IU's very first resilience cohort. And we'll find out later in the year, no doubt, from the cities as to how they're going to be able to put all this data that they gather to good use. And Janet, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this, about the work that IU's School of Environmental and Public Affairs is doing in this through the Institute, and how we can find out a little bit more in ways to keep the environment safer.
Well, thanks so much for having me and for your interest in the topic.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.